We're in the Rosh Chodesh Adar, the month of Laihuda Maisaora. I guess they didn't get the memo here. But we have two sessions actually before Purim, because two Monday nights time was already Purim itself, Purim of Prozim. And working back, therefore, I wanted to use this evening as the first of our two pre-Purim sessions. And as is our minhag, we use the first of those two to take a look at Megillas Esther. So if by some tragic circumstance all you have is the Chumash Shemos, all is not lost, because most of them have Megillas Esther in the back. And we are this year coming to look at Perek Zion. Perek Zion, which is a short of the shorter Prokim, but it contains a lot, of course, as we will see. So where are we in the grander scheme of things? Effectively, Perek Zion discusses the second Mishta, the second feast that Esther invites Achashverosh and Haman to. And how is everyone feeling as they are about to enter the second Mishteh? Well, Esther, obviously, this is the moment she's about to reveal what it's all about. Achashverosh will see, although on a simple level, he must be more wound up than ever, because the first Mishteh, nothing happened. Esther just asked for another Mishteh, which means he must be all suspense, all anticipation. And yet, it's possible that Achashverosh is anticipating something else, as we will see. What about Haman? The first Mishteh undoubtedly went better for him than this one is going to. In the meanwhile, things have begun to go downhill for him already. The day in between, that's the day that he was forced to parade Mordechai throughout the streets, Kachi Yaseh LaMelech, and things are only going to get worse. And I'd like to begin by comparing a nuance, really, of two of the psukim in our perek dealing with the second feast of Esther with those of the first. Because Perek Zion begins, Vayavo HaMelech VaHaman Lishtos Es Esther HaMalka. So the king and Haman, they come to the second feast. Literally, it says, they come to drink with Esther. Those are the words, Lishtos im Esther Hamalka, which is very interesting, especially when we compare it with the first Mishteh, and this is in Perek Hey, Pasuk Hey, where it says, almost identical, but a key difference. There it says, Vayavo HaMelech VaHaman El HaMishteh, Asher Asa Sa Esther, to the Mishteh, to the feast. Of course, the word Mishteh and Lishtos are very similar to each other. The word Mishteh comes from the word Lishtos. We translate it as a feast, but actually it's more of a drinking-based feast. That's why it's called the Mishteh. It's not called a Machal, and it's not called a Seuda. It's called the Mishteh. So what do people do at a Mishteh? Shoseh, aside from other things. And yet with all that, the first time round, the reference is to the Mishteh itself as an event, whereas the second time round, it's more to the verb of lishtos. What's between the two? And I think there's an atmospheric change between the two, in the sense that initially, when Esther comes, and it's a daring thing for her to come, everybody knows, if you haven't been invited, doesn't matter who you are, you're risking your life, and she does. And Achashverosh asks her, what does she want? And what she says is that the famous Malach, Mabakashaseh, Hatchasiya Malchus, and Esther says, if you're okay with this, Yavo Melech Vayom Vaman Hayom Ela Mishteh Asher Asisilo. What do I want? I want you and Haman to come to a Mishteh. Now at that stage, Achashverosh doesn't know what her request is. And in fact, it sounds like her request is the Mishteh. In response to asking, what is your request, she answered, I would like you and Haman to come to a Mishteh. That's it. So somehow at that stage, it sounds like that's her request, that they should have a feast together. And because that's how the request is perceived at that time, so when they come to this feast, it's stated, it's presented as such, Vayavoh HaMelech V'Haman El HaMishteh, to the feast, because at that time it was rated as the significant event. However, during that first feast, Achashverosh sees very clearly that Esther wants something else, which means that the Mishteh was not the request itself, although that's all she mentioned at the time, but rather it's a vehicle towards asking for something else. And that's why at the Mishteh he says, well, what do you want? I see that you clearly want, this wasn't it. You want something else. And Esther says, I'd like you to come to another Mishteh. But by this stage, Achashverosh and by extension Haman understand that the Mishteh is not the goal. It's a vehicle. It's a means towards attaining what she wants. And therefore, the second Mishteh is de-emphasized. At this point, it's no longer an event, but really a means towards an end. And that's communicated by shifting the reference from the event itself, the Mishteh, to the verb. Lishtos, and what's going to happen? Something else, clearly. So they're all there. Vayom HaMelech LeEsther Gam Bayom HaSheni B'Mishteh HaYayin. And Achashverosh says to Esther, Masha Elaseich Esther HaMakah V'Sinos Sein Lach. What is your question? Your request? Esther HaMalka V'Sinos Sein Lach Mavakash HaSeich Ad Chatzi HaMalchus V'Seos. Here, too, there's a bit of a shift, a nuance, in terms of what he said on day two to day one. In day one, the Pasuk says, that this is in Perikei Pasuk Vav, Vayom HaMelech LeEsther, Mashe LaSeich, V'Nasinach, what do you want? V'ma B'kosh HaSeich, Ad Chatzi HaMachus. Almost the same. The only difference is that the second time round, he doesn't just say Masha Elaseich, what do you want, but says Masha Elaseich Esther Hamalka. He interjects a formal reference to her as the queen. And the question is, what is the difference between just asking her what she wants, what do you want, or saying, what do you want, Esther Hamalka? Why would he emphasize that she's the queen the second time round? What's changed? So one could say, on a simple level, that he emphasizes the fact that she's Esther HaMalka because maybe he senses that she is has reservations about asking whatever it is that she wants. Clearly, she didn't ask at the time, she didn't ask on the first time, she might not even ask on the second time. They could be headed for an unlimited string of feasts because for some reason she's reticent and can't bring herself to ask for what it is that she really wants. And as much as Achashverosh likes parties, he'd like to know what Esther wants. And therefore, the first time round, he thought he's going to get the answer straight away. Mashe Laseich. But the answer wasn't forthcoming. She wants another Mishteh. So at the second Mishteh, Achashverosh says, Mashe Laseich Esther Hamalka. He stresses that you're the queen, as if to say you don't need to hold back from asking. He's encouraging her, in a sense, promoting her, that whatever that she wants, she's the queen, she shouldn't be embarrassed, and shouldn't have any reservations, and she should ask what it is that she wants. That's, I think, a simple approach why he emphasizes Esther Amalka here. You're the queen, you can ask, don't worry, don't make it another party, with all due respect. But it could be something else. Sometimes, when a person addresses someone else with formality, it's because they're planning a bit of an event themselves. As we saw last year in Perek Vav, in between the first feast and the second feast, Achashverosh has been busy. And he has been busy specifically trying to work out what Esther's request is. That's why in between the first feast and the second feast, what do we have? Balayla hahu, nodad ashnas hamelech. He can't sleep. Why not? What's bothering him? What's bothering him is, what on earth could Esther want? That's why he wants to know before the second feast. And that's why he calls for, as we saw last year, the Sefer Zichronos. Is there anything outstanding, anything? He knows that Esther is connected to Mordechai. Esther has brought him news in the past. in Mordechai's name, Papiktan Vateresh, so on and so forth. And therefore, he wants to find out, were things ever closed with Mordechai? He remembers that Sefer HaYomim, Divrei HaSichronos, Sefer HaYomim, whatever happened to Mordechai, was he rewarded for what he did? He was never rewarded. And Achashverosh is convinced, that's it! That's what Esther wants! And that's why he wants to seat it to reward Mordechai before the second feast. He's very proud of himself. As if to say, by the time Esther comes, and he's sure that she's going to be asking, well, you know, I know Mordechai, he was never really... And Achashverosh wants to have it dealt with already, especially as he'd prefer to reward Mordechai on his terms. Who knows what Esther will ask for him? And that's why it's a very smug Achashverosh, the second Mishteh, according to the Yosef Lekach, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, who's been guiding us all these years, when Achashverosh, it's a different atmosphere. Because when he says, Mashirasech Esther HaMalka, he addresses her formally because he's preparing to tell her, he wants to make a thing out of it, because he's pretty sure what she's going to say to him. Namely, it's about Mordechai, and then he'll say, it's already been taken care of. So that he wants to milk the moment, he wants to really get as much out of it as he can. Little did he know what Esther was going to respond to his question, but at the time, he thought that this was a great moment for him. Well, what does Esther say? Pasuk Gimel, Vatan Esther Hamalka Vatomar. So Esther responds, Imasasi chen be'einecha hamelech, v'mal hamelech tov, if I have found favor in your eyes, and if it's good for the king thinks it's good. And really what Esther is doing here is that she is combining two concepts, chen and tov. One is personal, and one is moral. And Esther wants to combine the two as if to say, what I'm about to request is something that, on the one hand, I hope you'll do for me because you like me, and she knows that he does. But on the other hand, it's something that you need to do anyway because I hope that you'll agree it's the right thing to do. A nation should not be exterminated. She doesn't wish to leave either of those out, or she doesn't wish to mention just one of them by themselves. If Esther just says, who knows, the king likes her, does he like her people? We don't know about that. So she needs to invoke the concept of justice also. Once he's in a good mood, people are in a good mood, like to be just. So she has to mention the fact that it's Tov to spare the Jewish people. But she doesn't just want to mention the fact that it's Tov, because then she's lecturing Achashverosh, if you want to do the right thing, so then you'll spare this people. Rather, she prefers to initiate with the issue of Chen, which he does like Esther, but when she has him with regards to Chen, so she says, and I'm sure you want to do the right thing, which of course Achashverosh, as we know, only ever wants to do the right thing. And therefore, she says, in Matzasi Chen Beinecha Melech, grant me my soul, that's my she'ela, va'amiba va'koshasi, and my nation for my request. And as we know, there are some who say that this is really the difference between she'ela and bakasha, two synonymous terms, almost. What's a she'ela? What's a bakasha? A request, what you seek. Some say a she'ela is more personal, a bakasha is more general, and that's why she answers. She'ela si is for me. Bakasha si is much more general. It's for my people. And this is the first time Achashverosh gets wind of the idea that she herself is somehow in trouble. And she continues, Ki nimkarnu ani va'ami, because me and my nation have been sold. And that's very interesting, because she there's room to say that she could have detached herself from the people and never told anyone, and she would have been okay, but she places herself with the people. We've all been sold. When Haman wants to kill them, he wants to kill me also. Lashmid, larog, ula'abed, to be absolutely exterminated and wiped out. And then she says, And these are words that need to be, we're familiar with the words, but really to understand them clearly, she says, had we just been sold as servants and as maidservants, I wouldn't have said anything. What is the meaning of those words? The oppressor does not equal damage to the king. What's the meaning of those words? Well, before we deal with those questions, Achashverosh's reaction is unbelievable. Who is this? Who would do such a thing? As if he doesn't know. But what does that mean? Does he really not know? I mean, he's part of it. In Perek Gimel. So Yosef Lekach says, there is no question that the way Haman presented his plan for the Jewish people, like he didn't name them, but let's assume it's understood that it's the Jewish people, Ahasuerus must have taken an interest, the way that Haman presents the plan is very open-ended. His words are, in Perek Gimel, im al ha-melech tov, yikasev, let it be written, le'abadam, to lose them. That's a euphemistic term, to lose them. But what does that mean? It could mean many things. And he's either giving Achashverosh a way of just allowing himself to think that he's not really part of what's happening, or maybe he really was trying to mislead Achashverosh. The way that he presents the situation is, you've got this people, and they're the cause of trouble. They're different than everyone else, they don't care about you, etc. and so forth, they scorn your laws, so on and so forth. So something has to be done. But the way to deal with the troublesome people is not necessarily to exterminate them. You just need to neutralize them, or maybe naturalize them. Oved is to lose them. They need to get lost with everyone else, somehow to find a way that they're not so distinct in their ways. That could mean many things. That could mean to prevail upon them to lose their Jewishness. If you do that, then they'll probably make good Persians, right? Jews always make the best citizens when they lose their Jewishness, right? So then they put it into other things.
Similarly.
Yes. Or perhaps a more drastic scenario is to enlist them into the workforce and crush them and so on and so forth. None of that is killing them. Achashverosh agrees to that. Why? Because that's good for his kingdom. It's good if they lose their Jewishness and then become naturalized as citizens. It's good if they're enlisted in the harsher elements of the workforce. That's good for him. And that's why Achashverosh's words to Haman at the time is, don't worry about the money, hakesef nasanach, v'ha'am la'asos bo katov be'einecha, and the nation to do with them whatever you want. That is a very important expression, because when you kill someone, that's not called doing something with them. That's called doing something to them. Killing is not something you do with a person. La'asos bo means something has to be done with them in order to turn this around. For us, Haman was much more explicit. Whereas his words to Achashverosh were la'abdam, his words to everybody else in power were la'ashmid, la'arog, ula'abed. That is a three-stage process, and la'abdam is number three, meaning that there's been nothing left by the time they're finished. That's altogether very different, which means it's possible to say, shall we say, al derech ha'pshat, that although Achashverosh is complicit in the plan of la'abdam, but it's for his benefit, but la'ashmid ula'arog ula'abed, no one ever spoke to him about that. Esther is very explicit. Nimkarnu aniva ami lashmid larog la'abed. It's the first time anyone mentioned extermination to Achashverosh. From a certain point of view, he's not a tzaddik, but no one ever told him about that. And that's why she goes on to say, v'ilu la'avadim v'lishbachos, etc. Nimkarnu hecharashti. You know, I know there's been a decree, and I know that you signed off on a decree, la'abdom. Had it only been to turn us into servants, So I couldn't petition you to reverse that, because that's for the good of your kingdom. It would have been bad for us, but it's for the good of your kingdom. In that case, Ein Hatzar Shoveh Benezek HaMelech, the oppressor wouldn't equal damage to the king. That wouldn't be damaging to you. So I couldn't say that you have to reverse it. But Lashmid V'Larog L'Abed is damaging to you. And therefore, surely none of that was part of what you signed off on. And that's why I'm saying that the whole thing needs to be reversed. Pasuk Hey. Vayomer Melech Achashverosh, Vayomer Esther Malka. Which again, there's two Vayomers, interestingly, Alderech HaPshat. The Mefarshim explain that first he consulted with other people before Esther, because he wants to know his possibilities before getting her take on the situation. Vayomer is first he asked around, and no one knew what was happening. And then he Vayomer le'Esther Malka, mi huze ve'ezehu Hashem la'olibo la'asos king. Who is it? And again, this expression, we're familiar with it, but it's a doubled over expression. What does it mean? Mi huze, who is this? Ve'ezeh who? And who is this who? Who is this him? It's got a lot of words there. Hashem la'olibo la'asos kein. What does he mean by mi huze ve'ezeh who? So Yosef Lekach explains that he wants to know two things. Number one, the identity of the person, mi huze. But number two, the motivation of the person. What is it? What is it that would cause a person to do that? Why does he want to destroy you? So mi huze, who's asking about the person, the eze who is asking about what is it that Hashem ala olibo lasos kein, that would bring him to do that. And that's why Esther answers by saying ish tsar v'oyev haman hara hazeh. She's in a sense answering both questions. His question was, who's the person and what's his motive? And therefore she says, you know what his motive is? He's our enemy. That's his motive. And you know who it is? It's Haman. There's the answer to both of your questions. Now, thus far, we've explained in a rather straightforward way, shall we say, al derech hapshat. That is to say, Achashverosh's reaction, he doesn't know, and maybe Alderech HaPshat, he didn't know, not the extent, not Lashmid, Larog, as we said already. He really was genuinely shocked. However, Chazal give us a bit of a different picture, a bit of a darker picture with regards to Achashverosh. You can see it from the very beginning of the Megillah. Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. Who Achashverosh? Who Achashverosh, says Rashi, he's a Rasha from beginning to end. Don't be fooled. He makes himself out like he's a likable person. He's a Rasha from beginning to end. And Esther knows this. And moreover, the Gemara says that when Esther's, this is a Gemara in Megillah, of course, the first parak of Megillah has like a built-in commentary on the much of Megillah's Esther. And when the Gemara says that when she started to say Ish Tsar V'Oyev, she almost like subconsciously was like pointing towards Achashverosh, right? He's the Tsar V'Oyev. He's the only one that can make it happen. Until a Malach comes in the expression of the Gemara, a Malach comes and like moves her hand towards Haman. Meaning Esther at this point is in a very, as the Vilna Gaon explains, whenever tzaddikim, their thoughts are never far from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means they tell the truth as HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees it, which is the truth, and Achashverosh is in it as well. And especially when they're in the presence of kingship, so they enlist into this connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means that the truth was about to come out about Achashverosh itself, which of course would not have augured well for anyone. So the Malach comes and modifies what Esther is saying and points her in the direction of Haman. But this brings us back to a very interesting point, which is made by the Yosef Lekach earlier on in Perek Beis. Namely, a lot is hidden within Megillas Esther. And a significant aspect of what's hidden is the truth about Achashverosh. You will never find a disparaging word said explicitly in the Megillah about Achashverosh. You will find plenty about Haman, But if you want to know Ahasuerus, you have to read between the lines. You have to get connected with the Masorah, etc. Why? Why would we be, if indeed they're equal, each one in their own way, why are we so respectful towards Ahasuerus, not so towards Haman? And the answer, says Yosef Lekach, is very simple, but fascinating. And that is, what is the story of Purim? What is the miracle? The miracle is that although Ahasuerus promulgated this decree, or ratified this decree, in the end he came to change his mind, and that's how the whole thing started. When we, at that time, we're in Galus. In the words of the Gemara, Akati Abdi Ahasuerus Hanan, we're subject to Ahasuerus' will at that stage. And the miracle, effectively, is that he began to have goodwill towards the Jewish people, and that itself is a miracle. And from a certain point of view, it's a greater miracle, because it's human nature and it's really up to him. But if that's the miracle, you do not wish to reverse the miracle by causing him to become angry again at the Jewish people. There's nothing that's going to get him more angry than hearing what the Megillah really thinks about him. And we should not forget, Megillah was written in Persia, and it was sent to everyone, and we can be quite sure one of the first people to get a leather-bound copy of the Book of Esther was Ahasuerus. And we can be equally sure that his copy of Megillas Esther did not have Rashi's commentary in it. And what that means is, so he is really reading a different Sefer than everyone else, in the sense that he starts, it's got a great beginning. He's mentioned twice in the first parak, in the first pasuk, Ba'i b'mei Ahasuerus, Hu Ahasuerus, he likes it already. He's twice in the first five words. He doesn't realize that the repetition is saying that he's a rusher from beginning to end. And therefore, anything that implicates Ahasuerus itself then becomes hidden in the Megillah. It's a very interesting limudah. And it's true. You never find the psukim talk openly, disparagingly, about Ahasuerus. So this is all very sudden. As we can appreciate, Haman didn't see it coming, because Haman didn't know that she's Jewish. Ahasuerus didn't see her coming. He thought he knew the answer already. He's just getting ready for it to say, this person I know is Mordechai, can you do something for him? It's all done. But she, this whole thing, and now it's Haman now. It's all very, very awkward. And as the Pasuk says in the end of Pasuk Vav, V'Haman niv'as mipnei ha-melech v'hamalka. Haman, he is just stunned. He's bewildered. He doesn't know what to do. Bifnei ha-melech v'hamalka. And Yosef Lekach says, the reason why the Pasuk emphasizes milifnei ha-melech v'hamalka is because it's specifically since he was in the presence of both of them together that he had no strategy here. Because if he was in the presence of one of them, he could have actually possibly gotten out of it. Namely, let's say, for example, he was only with Esther, and she confronts him. So at that point, Haman could say, I didn't realize you were Jewish, I never would have done it, I'll see what I can do, I feel so bad, I'll try and get Ahasuerus to change his mind. He could have said something like that with Esther, but not when Ahasuerus is there, because he's effectively saying, I told Ahasuerus this was good for him, and in, for your interest, I'll try and get him to change his mind to do something that's maybe not so good for him, and I'll do that for you. You can't say that in front of Ahasuerus. He can't hear you say, I'll ask the king to act in conflict with his interest for your personal well-being. So Ahasuerus being there, so he can no longer try and curry favor with Esther. On the other hand, let's say it was only Ahasuerus who then came to Haman and said, I've heard that you plan to kill the Jewish people. It's a little bit extreme. Can you explain it, etc.? So if Esther wasn't there, he could have explained it. Because he could have said, of course, I wanted to spare you the delicate parts of the situation.
Yeah, I have a torch.
Wait a second.
And the cell phone has also died. The cell phone.
Cell phones have a light.
Oh no.
1 minute. Almost there, yeah.
Thanks, man. It's a little bit more dramatic than even I had in mind. So again, if it's only Achashverosh, so he could really pile on the malice and the slander towards Bnei Yisrael and say that they really are that bad. He can't say that in front of Esther. Esther just revealed that she herself is Jewish, and therefore he's not able to malign the Jewish people, and that's why the pasuk emphasizes V'hama nivas milifnei hamelech v'hamalka, specifically before the king and the queen together. And it's for that reason, by the way, that as the next pasuk says, that Achashverosh v'hamelech, pasuk zayin, v'hamelech kam v'chamoso mimishte hayayin, he was angry and he gets up, he needs a bit of air. That was good for Haman, because now with Achashverosh out of the room, so Haman now can try and apply that idea of appealing to Esther, and I didn't mean it, I'm trying to get him to change his mind, which is exactly what the pasuk goes on to say. V'amelech kam b'chamoso mimishte hayayin el ginas habisan. So he goes out to the garden, and at that point, Haman said, okay, it's just Esther. V'haman amad levakesh al nafsho me'Esther hamalki. He tries to plead for his life from Esther. And Pasuk Zion concludes, Ki ra'ah, for he saw, Ki chalsa eilav hara'ah me'es ha-melech, because the evil was just ending for him, meaning it was all ending now for him from the king. Rabbeinu Bachya, in a couple of places, amongst them Parshas Bamidbar, notes, we are aware that at certain key points in Megillas Esther, there are allusions through the medium of Rosh Tevos, of acronyms, to Shem Hashem. Hashem's name is not mentioned explicitly in the Megillah for various reasons, but it is mentioned as part of the run of the words. From a certain point of view, as Mepharshim point out, it's very appropriate, because there was no one point in the Megillah isolated that you could say, oh, Hashem did that. In a sense, it's really the flow of events that's really, you've come to understand how Kadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated it. And therefore, in the same way that it's specifically by linking things together that you see the Hashgacha, so too Hashem's name comes out specifically from continuing and seeing words together, and it comes out from them. The classic example, again, Perek Hei, when Esther says, Yavo HaMelech VaHaman Hayom, the Rosh HaTevis of those words is Yud and Hei, Vav and Hei, Yavo HaMelech VaHaman Hayom. That's the beginning of Midas HaRachamim towards Bnei Yisrael. In this instance, it says, Ki Ra'ah Ki Chasa Eilav HaRa'ah. The words Ki Chasa Eilav HaRa'ah, says Rabbeinu Bachya, the Sofei Tevos are Yud and Hei, Vav and Hei. They're at the end, because at this point, it's the end for Haman. And that's why the difference between the Shem Hashem coming from the beginning of the word or from the end of the word. That's the idea of Rabbeinu Bachya. So Achashverosh goes out, and then the Pasuk says he came back again. And the Pasuk doesn't say what happened in between. It just says, V'hamelech shav b'meginas habisan el beis b'shteh hayayin. He comes back, but the Gemara fills in information for us, and it's one of the most glorious sections of the whole story. Because the Gemara says he went out to the garden to get some air and to calm himself and so on and so forth. What did he see there? Says the Gemara. There were malachim there. Kodesh Baruch Hu said malachim, and they were uprooting all of his trees. And he's like, who are you? And they said, Haman told us to do this. And when he heard that, he stormed back into the room. You thought he went there for peace and quiet. Haman is telling people to uproot his trees. Now, none of that, of course, was true. But what's happening? Says the Vilna Gaon, The full midah keneged midah for Haman is not just to kill him in the way that he wanted to kill Mordechai and the Jewish people. It's every aspect of what he did to the Jewish people. And how did it begin? Slander. To malign them. He said they're not good citizens. The Jewish people are the best citizens. They're against you. They're antagonistic. They're plotting against you. They're looking to take over. Whatever it is that he would say. The aggression begins with slander. With Lashon Hara. And that's why the end for Haman also began. He got a dose of Lashon Hara. Didn't help the situation. Who knows? Maybe Ahasuerus would have calmed down. He's not calm anymore. His prized trees are being uprooted, apparently, at Haman's behest. That was all he needed to hear. It's very similar to the Arachaim HaKadosh that we've mentioned with regards to Paro. Part of the reason why Paro was told initially 3 days, even though it was never really for 3 days, is because that's midah keneged midah. The way that he enslaved the Jewish people was through trickery. He cajoled them into it and gave them good conditions, which got progressively worse. The anguish of being duped into serving for Paro required that he suffer the anguish of being duped into letting them go. That's part of the midah keneged midah. In the meanwhile, there's another malach at work in the palace. Because when the king comes back, so Haman is trying to persuade Esther to have mercy on him. But Vahaman nofel alamita, but he fell on the bed, he's falling on the bed. Says the Gemara, a malach came and pushed him. That was the last thing Ahasuerus needed to see. He comes back, and Haman is lying on the bed there with Esther, and Ahasuerus utters his famous words, "Vayomer Hamelach, Hagam lichbosh es amalka imi babayis." You're looking to conquer the queen in my own house. That's like the worst possible time to, and the worst possible everything. It was just the only thing that could have gotten worse for Haman. Hadavar yatzam epi amelech. As soon as the king said that, upnei Haman chafu. They covered Haman's face. Ahasuerus doesn't even want to look at him at this stage. It looks like it can't get worse than this. But then it does. Who pipes up here? Vayomer Charvona. So we hear from Charvona. And who is Charvona? Echad asarisim lifnei hamelech. So one of the sarisim, one of the stewards before the king, and he says, "Oh, look at this tree here! Look at this gallows. Gami neha eitz asher asa Haman la Mordechai asher dibetov ala melech. This, look at the gallows that Haman made for Mordechai, who spoke well for the king. Omed beveis Haman gavah 50 amas, 50 amas tall. That was the worst thing could have happened." Ahasuerus says, "Okay, hang him on that gallows." Who is Charvona? And the Gemara actually gives us two opinions as to who he was. One of them, I think, is very well known. Namely, that it's Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi, he comes in the guise of Charvona. And indeed, it's for this reason that we say, in the end of Shoshanas Yaakov, V'gam Charvona Zachor Latov. V'gam Charvona, also Charvona Zachor Latov, may he be remembered for good. Where does that phrase come from? Says the Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov Molin, one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim, Gam Charvona L'Zachur LaTov is based on the idea that it's Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi Zachur LaTov. That's where it comes from. Interestingly, in one of the classic Shelas HaTshuvos, Maim Chaim, Rav Chaim Rappaport, so he says that this is the second time in the Haggadah, pardon me, in the Megillah, that we are meeting Charvona. The first time he's one of those advisors to the king, Vahakarovelov, or Charvona, he's one of those. Amar Limuan Charvona, etc. and so forth. And here too, he's back again, Charvona. But actually, if you look at these two times in the Megillah, you will see something interesting. The name Charvona is spelt differently. In Perek Aleph, Charvona is spelt with an Aleph at the end. In our Perek, Charvona is spelt with a Hey at the end. And what does that mean? Says the Rav Chaim Rappaport, Shelos HaTshuvos, Maim Chaim, this is an allusion to what the Gemara is saying, that it's Eliyahu HaNavi, because an Aleph at the end is a much more Aramaic name. It's indicative of a name that's possibly not even Jewish. Jewish names tend to end with the letter hey, and therefore he's referred to as the same person. But if you see Charona with an aleph at the end, and then later on you see Charona with a hey at the end, you understand that it's a different Charona, or a different version of Charona, namely Eliyahu HaNavi. The question is, why do Chazal... Oh, and there's this, the second opinion, pardon me. So the first, again, we said the well-known Eliyahu HaNavi. There is another opinion about who Charona was, and that he's just Charona. And what do we say about him? That he was originally involved with Haman. He was originally one of the cohorts of Haman, plotting against the Jewish people. However, he has an eye for the times, and he realizes that his alliance with Haman is not going to augur well for him, and therefore he bails at this critical moment and turns on Haman and says, oh, and he knows what, how does he know all about it? Because he's involved. So it's very interesting, two quite different opinions. The well-known is Eliyahu HaNavi, and maybe it was Charona. And he, on the contrary, he was originally to get in it with Haman. He turned at the right moment, and still we say, Gam Charona Zachur Lato. Why are Chazal looking to identify him? Where is Charona's Charona? We've met him before. Maybe he's just Charona. Why do we need to say more? That he's Eliyahu, or that he was involved? So the Mepharshim explained very simply. Because otherwise, how does he know so much? If he's just a steward in the king, how does he know so? He really has a lot of inside information. Look at the gallows, and you know Haman wants to hang Mordechai. How does he know all that? How could he have that information? And in fact, there's a further point, which is very interesting, and the Marsha points this out. It's a detail, but these details, they show. Chavona says, Gam hinei ha'etz asher Haman le'Mordechai. This is the gallows that Haman made for Mordechai. Asher debetev la'melech, who spoke well for the king. Omed be'beis Haman, it's standing in the house of Haman. Gavoa chamishim ama. It's 50 cubits high. That has to be the most extraneous piece of information to this whole situation. I mean, what is he, a surveyor? How does he know? It's 50. By my reckoning, that's 50 cubits. Who cares? What does it mean? How does he know? That's very, very detailed information. But the point is, he knows all of this, either because it's Eliyahu and Eliyahu knows, or because he was actually involved. It is interesting that there is another possibility, again, classic suggestion by the Yosef Lekach. Charona here is referred to as Echad min Hasarisim, one of the Sarisim. But what does that mean? When was the last time that we've seen a mention of the Sarisim? At the end of Perek Vav, where things have begun to unravel, really, for Haman. And he's had to lead Mordechai through the streets, and it's been a terrible day for him. And his family, as we saw last year, actually begin to try and dissuade him. As if to say, if things are looking good for Mordechai, it's not going to end well for you. Maybe you should pull out. And he says, no, I'm still going to hang him. I'm still going to do all of those things. I built the gallows, 50 amos high. They're talking about it. And what's amazing is the final pasuk of Perek Vav says, Odam midabrim imo. They were still talking with him. And who arrived? V'sarisei ha-melech higiyu. The king Sarisim came. In other words, says the Yosef Lekach, it could be that Charona is referred to as Echad min ha-Sarisim. He's one of the Sarisim, meaning he's one of the Sarisim who came to bring Haman to the feast. And that's why he knows so much, because he heard them talking about it. Because as the pasuk says, they were still talking when the Sarisim came, and therefore he overheard this conversation. Very interesting. Once again, Yosef Lekach, Al Derech HaPshat. But it's also important to realize that Charvona's contribution, shall we say, to the demise of Haman. Because until this point, as far as we're concerned, it's all over for Haman, but it's not so clear. He is for sure in disgrace. He is for sure offside of the king, but so far, as much for all of his crimes, is he yet destined to be killed? Not yet. No one said anything. The king didn't react instantly as if to say, you wish to kill Esther, so, and her people, so you should be killed. And even when he's falling on the bed with Esther, Ahasuerus is terribly upset with him, but there's never been a verdict to kill him. That only happens because of Chavona. And that's why Chavona begins with the word Gam. Gam hine ha'etz. There's more to it than that. He's not just saying, look at that tree. In addition to everything else, it changes everything. Because also there's this tree. And why does the tree change things? Because the implications of the tree, the gallows, that is to say, is directly towards the king. Because what is it? It's the gallows that Haman made to hang Mordechai. Hashem diber tova lamelech. But he spoke well for he's the king. He's a friend of yours. And it's standing in Haman's house. And it's gavoa chamishim amah. That means why does he mention that? It's meant to be visible. He wants people to see. This changes everything. Because now it's between Haman and Ahasuerus. Mordechai, who is the person that Haman wished to honor, and Haman wants to kill him and hang him publicly, that is a statement against the king. That's the point where Ahasuerus says, Teluhu alav. And I think there is a further point. It's interesting, we say in the Shoshanat Yaakov, V'gam Charvona, also Charvona. Maybe that's his name, Gam Chavona, because his contribution started with Gam Hinei Ha'etz, etc. But there is a further point which is fascinating. I saw it in one of the Meforshim. I don't recall offhand which one. I have to chase it down. But it could be that there's more to what's happening between Ahasuerus and Haman here, specifically because of Mordechai. Namely, it's not just that Ahasuerus likes Mordechai, Haman wants to kill Mordechai. Maybe there's more to it. One of the most traumatic events of Megillas Esther for Ahasuerus is the plot against his life from Bigtan and Teresh, in the end of Perek Beis. Bigtan and Teresh, Katzah Bigtan and Teresh, they want to kill Ahasuerus. The Pasuk never really says why, what they were so angry about, to the extent that they wanted to kill him. It does say they were angry. But what does Ahasuerus know? Ahasuerus knows only one thing. Two of his stewards, right, Shnei Sarisei HaMelech, are trying to kill him. But it's important to realize that in a situation like this, it's unusual that two low-level stewards themselves would hatch a plot to kill the king. Because then what's going to happen? Well, one of them is going to get promoted. There's no question that they're being backed by someone. We know from the Megillah that it was actually their own idea. Katzapik Zamvaterish. Go figure out why they were so angry. They want to kill him. They're not going to get promoted into his place. They're going to be stewards for the next person. But in the mind of Ahasuerus, a low-level person like that, and he's the one that's chosen, someone must have put him up to it. Someone wants to step in if I would be killed. And he never finds out who that person is. All he knows, it's amazing to consider it in this way, all he knows is that Mordechai uncovered the plot and Bigtan and Teresh were killed. But the trail ended there. And he never really found out what was clear to him. Someone must have put them up to it. Someone must be behind it. But now he thinks he's found out. Why? Because Mordechai, who saved him and who he honored, Haman wants to kill Mordechai. And Ahasuerus begins to think that he's put two and two together. Why does Haman want to kill Mordechai? Mordechai saved my life that time. And Haman hates him enough to kill him. Maybe Haman was the one behind Bigtan and Teresh. And therefore it's no longer just a question of he wants to kill Mordechai, who's my friend. He's the one that wanted to kill me. That's the conclusion of Ahasuerus. So hang him on the tree. Just like you hang Bigtan and Teresh, and he wanted to hang Mordechai, hang him on the tree. And I think that there's an amazing irony here. And of course, Megillas Esther is full of ironies. Namely, Ahasuerus is not aware of Haman's history with Mordechai. We are, even from the Megillah. We know that it all started when Mordechai makes a point of not bowing down to Haman. And Haman is incensed against Mordechai. And the Pasuk says, but he doesn't just want to get back at Mordechai. That would be personal. He feels that's like a petty thing. He turns into a whole thing against the Jewish people. As the Pasuk says, Vayivez be'enav, Lishloch Yad B'Mordechai Levado. He wants to destroy the whole people. And that means that his real trigger was his bad experience with antagonism towards Mordechai. But he doesn't say that to the king. He makes it all about, there's this nation and they're not good for you, etc. and so forth. And he hopes to chap Mordechai in with them. So what's amazing about the situation is, had he not hidden his antagonism towards Mordechai, so then at this later stage, Achashverosh would have understood differently why he wants to kill Mordechai. It's got nothing to do with the king. It's got to do with him and Mordechai. They've got bad blood between them. So had he been forthcoming about his real motivation at the time, so perhaps he wouldn't have had such a harsh sentence now. But because he hid his antagonism towards Mordechai, Achashverosh never heard about it. Which means that the only association that he understands between Haman and Mordechai is that Mordechai saved my life, and Haman now wants to get rid of him. It's about Haman and me. So that's an amazing v'nafachu, in a sense, in terms of this whole situation. Achashverosh utters the words, Teluhu alav, hang him on those gallows. As we've mentioned in the past, this is also a closing of a circle. In the beginning of Perek Aleph, we see that Achashverosh, when he has a critical decision to make, he's surrounded by committees. You can't get enough names. The seven of these, seven of the others, another seven. Yodi Ha'itim, Yodi Dasvadin. He doesn't know what to do. And Haman not only suggests what he should do, but also suggests a new type of law. And that's called Dvar Malchus. Im Yetzei, Im Alamelech Tov, Yetzei Dvar Malchus Milafonav. A royal decree. But what does that mean? What Haman is offering to Achashverosh is that if it's really about you, then you should be able to decide without any committee, without anything like that. And that's why it was so appealing to Achashverosh, because he was empowered by Haman. And that's why, for example, when Bigtan and Teresh plot against him, there's no committees, because it's them and him. He has them hanged, and it felt great. And that's why the next thing he does is to promote Haman, because that's gratitude to Haman for giving him the power, as effectively, to act unilaterally and by himself, independently, that's to say, in anything that's called a Dvar Malchus. It's this very idea that Haman wished to use to destroy the Jewish people, because he made them out to be antagonistic towards the king personally. So then the king doesn't need to ratify it with any of the boards. He can just yikasev la'abdam, because it's between them and you. But ultimately, it all came round to Haman. Because once Harvona says, it's between Haman and Achashverosh, Achashverosh said, hang him on the gallows. Those two words. In times gone by, he never would have been able to say that. He would have had to now consult with the committees, etc. And Haman was on those committees. And he would probably have been able to get out of it somehow. But Achashverosh didn't need to consult anyone. Thanks to Haman, who gave him that power, which then, in the end, killed Haman. And that's why Haman is called Memuchan in Perek Aleph. Because he's preparing. He's preparing, as the Gemara's Memuchan Aparonis, he's preparing disaster for himself. Not only did Haman build the gallows upon which he was hanged physically, he did so constitutionally as well, because he allowed for the constitution to have Achashverosh sentence him to death without anyone else having to be involved. And with that, the circle is closed. Haman is killed, as the final pasuk says, "Vayisluas Haman ala'etz asheichin l'Mordechai." They hanged Haman. V'chamas hamelech shachachan, the king's anger abated. And as the Gemara points out, there's two kafs, shachacha. And it's doubled over because Achashverosh's anger abated, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's anger abated. This is the other side of the beginning of the last perek, Balailahu Nodedosh Nas HaMelech. The Dalet is doubled over, and the Gemara says, Achashverosh and Malko Shel Olam. So there was agitation on two levels, Nodedosh Nas HaMelech, and then there's resolution, and the anger abates on both levels, Chamas HaMelech Shachacha. As we can appreciate, the story of Esther does not end there. Haman has been killed. The Jewish people are still in trouble. And what needs to happen now is that the abating of the king's anger should not become the end of the story. Esther appealed to Ahasuerus, if I find favor in your eyes, and if you want to do the right thing. And in the end, Ahasuerus is motivated by neither of those things. Not favor, and not justice, anger. But if he's motivated by anger to kill Haman, then when his anger abates, he might forget the whole story, which cannot be allowed to happen. The Jewish people are still in trouble, and that's why Esther and now Mordechai need to persist and make sure that Ahasuerus sees things through and allows the Jewish people to defend themselves, to rescind the decree, all of which will be discussed in Perek Ches. We'll leave it over there for this evening.